When I was teaching Latin American studies and Latin American literature out at the University of California, I took a sabbatical and went to Chile when Salvador Allende was president. And I did a lot of work and wrote a book on the people behind the right-wing work stoppage in October, which was right before, a year before the coup. Mm-hmm. And so when I came back, I felt like I had to do social justice work, that the military coup in Chile killed my friends, including Americans. It killed people I had worked with there, and it tore my heart out. And so I went to work with the United Farm Workers Union and Cesar Chavez. And from there, it's been organizing, organizing, mm-hmm. organizing. And I came here for the job of a lifetime. I got to teach adult workers here for 30 years.
Now, you went into, basically, you became a professor of labor studies. For folks who are not familiar with that particular discipline, what does that involve?
This was one of the few programs in the country where we taught credit classes for degrees, and we also did non-credit training.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, you could get a Bachelor of Science degree in labor studies, and I taught labor history, I taught labor law, I taught collective bargaining, comparative labor movements. You had to step up and be able to teach many things. But I also taught grievance handling, and I taught arbitration. And it was wonderful because there are no better students than adult students. Mm-hmm. They come to you saying they know nothing, but they know so much more than traditional undergraduates. I now teach a course at the School of the Art Institute on social movements, but my students are kids. And they don't know anything, and they don't know that they don't know.
that's and sometimes that's dangerous in its own right, too,
that's
I suppose.
Right.
Too.
I prefer the workers, but these kids are fun.
Now, you're talking about having a chance to be able to educate adults. In this case, we're talking about steel workers. That's how you, I guess, was Swing Shift College
Swing
is what
Shift.
You and a colleague created at the IU Northwest.
Well, no, it was me, really, that created it. But I worked very closely with the steel mills. And with the university to put together a customized program for workers who work swing shifts, also who have been out of school for decades and whose prior school experience was probably lousy.
Mm-hmm.
And so we saw building confidence. We saw giving people an understanding of their own lives as a core necessity for them to be able to learn new things. And we graduated many, many people, well over, 120, but there were groups that went through together, and the peer experience created a great learning community.
Was this a kind of experience that probably is a predecessor to what we see today with Ivy Tech Community College, where we have so much adult learning?
No.
Okay.
No, because what we were doing was based in part on the thinking of a man named Paulo Freire, who was a philosopher and an educator in Brazil, who developed a system of learning that was student-based, student-centered, problem-centered. And so our classes always began with what people already knew, so that what they were learning would have a place to fit into their worldview. And we gave people a lot of literacy education. We helped people deal with difficult topics from math to geology to geography. And we did it swing shifted. Plus, we videotaped. So at the beginning, people could take home a videotape. Then they could take home a DVD. And finally, it was streamed. So if they worked a double, or they worked a 10-hour day or a 12-hour day, they could watch the class. And our students were some of the smartest students on campus. And it was a community experience that really showed how intelligent workers are if they are supported in a peer group and if their knowledge is taken seriously and if it is valued.
Is there anything that is like it today that we see in the system, either with Indiana University Northwest or Purdue Northwest or any other university?
Not that I know of. And that's why it was so important, because it really broke new ground in educational theory and practice.
Now, how did you take this opportunity to be able to teach labor studies and all the other things there at IU Northwest and put that information together by being a resident of the region and seeing and hearing as much as you did that got you so involved as being a community activist locally, because you were, of course, an activist in the past as well through the years. But what brought you to focus in on Northwest Indiana?
Well, my students. Right? We were talking about their lives. We were talking about their experience. My first course in Swing Shift was called SOS, the State of Steel. And part of what we did was we designed that class with steelworkers so that it would be attractive to steelworkers. We took people on field trips. I had them write essays on if I were the CEO of Bethlehem, what would I do differently? Mm-hmm. But most of all, you know, I wrote a book on black steelworkers in Northwest Indiana. And so I did a ton of research on the whole history of workers and communities, working class communities in Northwest Indiana. And it kept me pretty busy, but once I retired, I became involved with the Northwest Indiana Federation of Interfaith Organizations that has been fighting for local hiring, for development projects that benefit the community, and especially dealing with the very large number of African Americans in Gary who have been unemployed long term, who basically have given up hope. And if you stick them into a training program, they'll fail because they don't have the kind of support systems we had at Swing Shift College. And so I've been involved fighting many of the development projects that have taken place. I picketed my own university a year ago because they built a building and didn't hire anybody from Gary. Mm-hmm. And they had promised that they would. And so I was involved in the GEO struggle to prevent an immigrant prison run by one of the worst, disgusting companies in the country from taking root here. It would have harmed even further. And one of the things that city council women, both Reagan Hatcher and Levita Sparkwaites, talked about at the last city council meeting was that a lot of people look at Gary and said, we have to take anything we can get because we're worthless. And we believe that Gary is not worthless. Gary has an incredible lakefront. It has national park areas. It has dunes. It has marshes. And it has a resourceful large population of people who can learn, will learn, and can work. And so we want development projects that actually enhance our city. And that doesn't mean an industrial park where Ivanhoe used to be. And it certainly doesn't mean, as the Jupiter Project suggests, another landfill that will take in all the demolition that's being done, which includes lead pipes, it includes lead paint, and of course many other toxic contaminants.
What have you and your colleagues and your fellow activists have thought about with all of this open space that is that can be developed here within the city of Gary, what that should go to? It's not all of it certainly would be appropriate within neighborhoods, the old neighborhoods that are being narrowed down because they have all the open spaces for all the abandoned buildings and the like. But what there's got to be some use for this this land here. What are your folks thinking about to put this land to good use as opposed to being more industrial park space?
Well, there's a number of things. One is, of course, to rebuild the communities themselves and provide parks and resources, libraries for the communities that were there that have been devastated and could be brought back using, for example, TIF funds. But the TIF that was passed last week at the Common Council will make it possible to build a road in front of the industrial park to enable or facilitate trucks coming in and out. To me, that's further pollution of what was once a livable, warm community. So one is to rebuild communities, but also there is a lot of work we could be doing. There's a lot of advanced manufacturing, small companies that could be set up here, and I think we have not even address the issue of cooperatives. And cooperatives have been a source of employment and even prosperity for a lot of workers throughout the world, including in this country, in Ohio and in Mississippi. They have cooperatives that provide jobs, provide training, and also enhance the community. You can't build a community next to a toxic landfill. And this toxic landfill, which they're going to claim is not toxic, is also, after it's all filled up and they want maximum stuffing it in, will be sold back to the city, which means the liability is sold back to the city. And they're talking about using it for public or recreational use. Go play in our lead, or let's bring West Calumet over to Gary and have yet another crisis. And it's already reported that our lead in our water is almost the same as East Chicago.
Mm-hmm. In fact, let's talk about East Chicago. You had a chance to talk with city officials, be present for meetings. We know very well about the documented problems in the city of East Chicago, and in particular in the Calumet neighborhood. And we've reported quite a bit of it here on Lakeshore Public Radio during the last few months. But you had a chance to sit in on a meeting with the mayor. Tell us about that conversation and how you hope things will, with everything that has been discussed, at least in recent weeks, can be leading, I guess, to hopefully some solutions, or at least pushing some solutions along.
This is a tragedy that's immeasurable. But one of the bright sides, and I think it became clear at the meeting on Friday last week, and the mayor has agreed to meet with the citizens of West Calumet every Friday morning from now to eternity, mm-hmm. until this is resolved, is that local people are speaking for themselves. It was a joy to be at this meeting. I didn't say a word, because the people who live there, including the leadership, the council in the old age home, Nicosia, mm-hmm. which was one of the worst, because the owners of Nicosia would not allow people on site to test. And it turns out that it was one of the most contaminated buildings in the whole area. And now they can't even do testing in that building because it's too polluted and contaminated. But there were the leader, Mrs. Lowe from the Nicosia building, spoke out eloquently about their problems and their needs, why seniors are not getting into cars and driving over for blood testing at the public health department. These are people who have been battered, abused, threatened, and some immobile. And so you have to really make special arrangements. Also, Maritza Lopez, who has been chairing a CAG, which is a community action group with EPA, spoke, as well as Akeisha Daniels. And these are people from the neighborhood. And the mayor said, "You were right, I was wrong." That is almost never heard in this country. And so he has now written a letter to the governor, to be, and the governor right now, saying this needs to be declared an emergency because we don't have the funds to deal with it. And everybody knew that was the case from the beginning, because this goes back to the 70s. And they already knew by 1984. Visclosky wrote a letter in, I think it was 84, 86, saying this is a catastrophe. This is toxic contamination. This will be a disaster. And nothing was done. So now there's some movement. It doesn't change the disaster. The people who live there have nowhere else to go. Zones 2 and 3, we have some people who have owned homes for 50-plus years. And their home absolutely dropped catastrophically in value the day they discovered the lead. Mm-hmm. And so now, if they were to sell their houses, they would get nothing. So they are demanding to be reimbursed the real value of their house prior to the lead crisis. And if they can clean up some of those areas, fine. But every time they dig, they send lead into the air because the lead has all leached upwards. And they have signs all over the area, "Don't play in the dirt." Well, where are the kids going to go? They have to walk through the dirt to get to the school bus. There's school.
Do you think that you'll have an opportunity or you'll take the opportunity if you get to go to these Friday meetings with the mayor and the folks in the neighborhoods that are affected and hear what the latest is and find out more and what Mayor Copeland is able to do?
I am planning to attend the meetings, and I have tried to be as supportive as possible. Anyone who goes to my Facebook page can see photos of these people speaking out from day one, demanding to be heard. Now the mayor is hearing them. But there were many efforts to divide, to stall, to discourage any citizenship engagement. Mm-hmm. And the only way they will get their needs met is if they are speaking for themselves.